This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Hey, good evening. This is part two of the first part was about a tactic I call stupid, crazy, evil. I hope you listened to that because I'm going to go into that in a little bit more detail. Specifically, I'm going to talk about pathologization and demonization and where that comes from. But let me just review a little bit and make some additional points that didn't fit in that last half-hour installment. This tactic is successful. It works, and other groups have copied the idea and use it. The term Islamophobia is one example of that, and homophobia, you know, the idea being that you've got to be crazy to be a critic of either Muslims or homosexuals. And the idea is, I mentioned at the end, that this is related to us and them thinking, and that it divides society into an us, the victims, and a them, the oppressors, two-class society. And that even supposed liberals and the idea of liberalism, I think you could boil down to everyone is us. At least white liberals think that way, that there is no us in them. It's just everyone is us. We're not allowed to discriminate. We're not allowed to make distinctions and say that other people aren't us, because that's racist. And of course, the big exception to that rule is those crazy, racist KKK Nazis. Those people are scum, and they're not us. They're them. So even these deluded white liberals actually do operate under us and them thinking. They just are deluded to think that they don't. So us and them is very important, and specifically, it's important because it helps you to understand the context here is a struggle between different groups, and that it's a war, that you could certainly use that word and be justified in using it. I talked about Cassandra Jackson a couple of installments ago. I think it was the one about guilt tripping, titled Guilt Tripping. She was the black professor who claimed that Obamacare that white people were warring on black and brown people by opposing, politically opposing Obama's healthcare plan. And as we've discovered since then, the Supreme Court actually reviewed that and passed it by a 5-4 vote. And the swing vote was a surprise. The Chief Justice, who was considered a strict constructionalist, meaning he really values the Constitution, and he had to really twist the logic to find a way in which this decision would be constitutional, this Obamacare. And I think, personally, that the reason he did it, he was motivated to do it, was because of the guilt tripping. And because he was looking for, he's a relatively young guy, and he's looking forward to the next 20 years on the court, and he doesn't want to be known as that racist white guy who warred on the black and brown people, or helped the war on the black and brown people, because he clearly can see the population demographic trends in America. And even though he's guaranteed his seat on the court, He cares about his legacy, probably, and doesn't want to be seen as a horrible, stupid, crazy, evil, racist KKK Nazi. So it is a war, and there's a fellow named von Clausewitz who, in the early 1800s, a Western military historian, who came up with this expression that's pretty popular, that war is politics by other means. And that's a very Western way of seeing war. But there is an alternative to that, the Eastern way of seeing it, Sun Tzu, the Oriental way of seeing it, is that if you can wage war without fighting, that's the best kind of war to wage. And that is basically that what that means is that politics is war by other means. It's the opposite of what von Clausewitz, the way von Clausewitz saw it and the way most Westerners see it. And I would say, I've used the expression before, meme war, that we're in a war of ideas, and it's a competition of ideas and tactical, intellectual tactics and tactics of argument. People like E. Michael Jones and Pat Buchanan talk about it as a cultural war. I think either misunderstanding it or euphemizing it in Buchanan's case. But war is the terms that they see it in, and I think that that's correct. War doesn't have to be a shooting war, just like a genocide doesn't have to be cutting people's heads off with machetes. You know, white people are kept from recognizing and acting in our collective interests by these poisonous ideas that keep us demoralized and confused and disorganized, keep us from organizing as a group. A lot of white people think it's just a bad idea to do it, and they could even go into detail about why they think it's bad or don't care or whatever. They have lots of excuses. That's what the guilt tripping and the litany of white sins is necessary for, and that's what it produces, is apathy and excuses. This us and them thinking, back to the us and them. This is a very illiberal idea, and liberalism is the idea that everyone is us. So, you know, who is us and who is them in this case? You know, who's being aggressed against? Well, I think it's clear that white people are the ones being aggressed against, certainly to a first approximation. That's who the target is of this guilt-tripping and stupid, crazy, evil stuff. And the them, in this case, is non-whites. And I think the template for the non-whites is clearly Jews. I think that's where the example comes from. That's the playbook that's being followed. I think blacks and Latinos in particular aren't intelligent enough to have created these psychological attacks against us. But they are at least intelligent enough to follow an example that's set for them, especially when Jews lend them so much aid via the media and funding and politics. I should have prepared better right beforehand. I have a page I need to look at to see how much time I have. All right. So pathologization, as I described last time, you know, calling somebody stupid or crazy, you're pathologizing them. You're saying that they're defective mentally. They have a problem with their brain. It's unhealthy in some way. And let me focus on that one in particular for a bit here. There's a great book. I'll probably do a program dedicated just to this one book, but I'll mention it quickly here. It's called The Ordeal of Civility, written by John Murray Cudahy, an Irish fellow, as far as I understand, published sometime in the early 70s. And its subtitle is Freud, Marx, Levi Strauss, and the Jewish struggle with modernity. It's it focuses on those three guys, but those three men, but it's really about the an overarching tendency of Jews in the wake of the Jewish emancipation to make excuses for their tribe and to blame basically all the problems of their integration into Western society on white people instead of themselves. And, you know, it's anti-Semitism is a good example of that, where, you know, if you ask any Jew what anti-Semitism is, it's something that stupid, crazy, evil white people are guilty of doing. And they do it for no reason whatsoever. It's just spontaneous. It certainly has absolutely nothing to do with anything that Jews do. It's 0% Jewish responsibility for anything that they're doing. It's 100% crazy, stupid, crazy evil white people. So that's really the root of this pathologization that I see. Freud, in particular, as the founder of psychoanalysis, that is pathologizing. Psychoanalysis is not just, and Freud's brand of it, was not just about diagnosing the problems of individual people and trying to solve their problems. It was about diagnosing the problems of Western civilization, and he saw Western civilization having massive problems caused by repression and so forth, sexual hang-ups amongst white people. And there's a lot to say about that, but I'll leave it at that. Cudahy described Freud, he might have been quoting somebody else, he said his life's work, Freud's life's work, was to make sense of Jewish emancipation, which is, I think, a charitable way of describing it. I think it was actually much less innocuous than that. And Freud was doing his work at around the turn of the last century, 1900 or so. Another prominent example I can think of is a fellow named Theodore Adorno. This fellow was half Jewish. I think his father was Jewish. He's a prominent member of the Frankfurt School, or was a prominent member of the Frankfurt School, a father of critical theory. The Frankfurt School is at the epicenter of cultural Marxism, which is the fusion of Freudianism and Marxism. It's about critiquing Western society, like what Freud did. And it's sort of picking up where Freud left off, fusing Freud and Marx. And he wrote a paper he published in 1950 called The Authoritarian Personality. I won't quote from it, but let me quote what at least the Wikipedia, which is fairly friendly to Jews, had to say about, you know, what his motives were in publishing this work. Quote, "The impetus of the authoritarian personality was the Holocaust, the attempted genocidal extinction of European Jews by Adolf Hitler's National Socialist Party." Adorno had been a member of the Frankfurt School, a predominantly Jewish group of philosophers and Marxist theorists who fled Germany when Hitler shut down their Institute for Social Research. So, you know, in other words, he was he had an axe to grind. He was upset with white people for what, you know, the mother of all race-based libels against white people, which is the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust narrative. And the book, The Authoritarian Personality, was actually part of a, quote, Studies in Prejudice, unquote, series sponsored by the American Jewish Committee. So, you know, it wasn't just this one man with his Jewish identity that decided to do this. He was sponsored by organized Jewry. Jews politically organized to pursue their best interests. So their best interests are to keep white people guilt-tripped and thinking that they're somehow mentally or morally flawed and have something to apologize for when it comes to our relations with Jews. Another good example after Adorno in time is in 1964, a fellow named Richard Hofstadter, also half Jewish, published an essay in Harper's Magazine called "The Paranoid Style in American Politics." Now, this fellow is a lifelong communist, and his essential point of this essay was to say that his opponents on the other side of politics were crazy because they saw commies everywhere. So here, the lifelong communist saying this. I thought I could actually quote a little bit, I guess, from his essay. I think this is instructive. He says, American politics, this is how he begins the thing. American politics has often been an arena for angry minds. In recent years, we have seen angry minds at work among extreme right-wingers who have now demonstrated in the Goldwater movement how much political leverage can be got out of animosities and passions of a small minority. I mean, talk about projection there. The animosities and passions of a small minority immediately makes me think of the Jews, because that's what they do very, very well to their advantage. Is focus those animosities and passions. And even though they are a small minority, they have a tremendous effect on politics and generally get their way. He goes on to say that he's actually admitting that he doesn't really actually think that they're crazy. He's calling them crazy, but he doesn't think it's actually – he's not using the term paranoid mind in a clinical fashion, he says. But he says that they're behaving in that way. And he says that the term is pejorative to call somebody paranoid, and it's meant to be in his use of it. Further on in his essay, he has a section titled "Why They Feel Dispossessed," meaning white people like us. Now, keep in mind, he's writing this in 1964. This is right in the wake, it's the same year. I don't know if it was before or after the Immigration Act was passed. But the United States immigration laws were drastically changed in 64, and it was the beginning of the end of the white majority in the country. So, he's writing here about white people being paranoid that they're being dispossessed. And it's a plausible argument to have made back then. In fact, Kennedy, when he was talking about passing that immigration thing, he argued that the other side was essentially being paranoid in thinking that the cities were going to be filled with immigrants and that there were going to be more than a million immigrants a year coming and that it was going to change, the change in immigration law was going to change the demographic mix of the country, that was all just people's paranoid imaginations. And that's the context here that Hofstadter's writing in too. And we know, though, in retrospect, that it wasn't crazy. It wasn't paranoid for people to think that, because here we are, and we are being dispossessed. The United States is becoming white people are becoming a minority. It's actually being celebrated now. You know, it went from being something that, you have to be crazy to think that that's going to happen. That would be a terrible thing, was the assumption. And of course it's not going to happen, to now, it's happened, and you're a terrible person if you think there's something wrong with it. So anyway, in his wiki page, talks about Hofstadter's being raised as an Episcopalian, but later came to identify more with his Jewish roots. Well, no kidding. You know, that was probably the attraction of communism for him, and why he attacked and tried to pathologize. You know, he was following the long history, the Jewish example of pathologizing white people for simply wanting to, you know, do what's best for them as a group. The idea that it's crazy that white people look out for their own interests as a group is pretty unique to and uniquely applied to white people. And this idea was originated by Jews. It traces back to the late 1700s, early 1800s. A story that came out of their own telling of history from their own point of view about being an oppressed minority for 2,000 years. And who was their oppressors? White people. And this is long before Latinos or blacks or Asians or any other oppressed minority took up that playbook and started using the same plays. So let's move on to the other example here, the other way that we're attacked, which is demonization, which is maybe the more serious one. And that is, you know, when you're demonizing somebody, you're portraying them as wicked and threatening. You know, you've got to do something about them. As I said in the last installment, calling somebody evil is really marking them for destruction. You're basically saying you're justified in trying to destroy them too, because they're evil. They're bad. You're passing judgment on them. You're condemning them. These are the sorts of things that are usually associated with religion. And in the West, the religion that comes to people's minds first is Christianity. And what we're taught that the Christian Bible says. And of course, that's based at least in part on teachings of Jews that predates Christianity, and it figures very large in the Christian understanding of religion, of what's good and what's bad. In the Christian understanding, though, and when political discourse and social discourse was dominated by Christians, it was all about hellfire and brimstone. That was the punishment that we faced if we did something bad, and the epitome of evil was Satan or the devil. Today, of course, there are still people who speak in terms like that, but if they do it in public, and especially if they got up in front of Congress and tried to do it for political reasons, they would be mocked and ridiculed. They are mocked and ridiculed in today's discourse. So today's discourse and the guilt tripping or the demonization, I should say, that's done is not done in terms of telling people that they're going to burn in hell and comparing them to Satan and the devil. There are people who do that, but it isn't very effective. It isn't the main way that it's done. And let's be honest, in today's political discourse, the terms are Jewish terms. The scary stories about hellfire and brimstone have been replaced by scary Jewish stories about the oppression of and suffering of minorities, you know, because they're discriminated against, racism. And the epitome of this, the jewel in the crown is the Holocaust. That's the sort of the cornerstone of those scary stories, those the hellfire and brimstone. And in the Jewish or Judaized political discourse, the devil has been replaced by Hitler. Anyone who wants to demonize somebody just compares them to Hitler. That is a very explicit comparison. It's become so ridiculous that there's actually a saying for it on the internet. I forget what they call it, the fellow's name. Somebody's law. It's argumentum ad Hitlerum, the probability that Hitler will come up in any political discussion or any argument, actually, somebody will be compared to Hitler, approaches one as the length of the argument goes on. And that's a reflection of the fact that the Jews and their sensibilities dominate in today's discourse. They're the ones dictating the morals to the rest of us. Not everybody goes along with it, but certainly for appearance sake, they do. And, you know, people who are compared to Hitler, Ahmadinejad, David Duke, you know, even somebody like Pat Buchanan. I'm sure you could, if you Google Pat Buchanan Hitler, you'd find some crazy Jew or another making that comparison. Another very contemporary example, I think, of this both sort of a combination of pathologization and demonization is something that hasn't quite become very popular yet, but it is out there and it seems to be growing in strength. And that is this idea of eliminationism. It's sort of the natural, it's part of that progression from stupid and crazy to evil. You know, when Hofstadter was writing about people being paranoid, right-wingers being paranoid that they were going to be dispossessed, well, now that we are dispossessed, the attack on us has been ratcheted up to now we're evil for trying to for noticing that we're being dispossessed and that it's real and arguing against it. And it's sort of a projection. It's the, when you look it up, there's a wiki page on it, a Wikipedia page that says that the term was coined by American political scientist Daniel Goldhagen and his in his 1996 book Hitler's Willing Executioners, in which he posits that ordinary Germans not only knew about but also supported the Holocaust because of a unique and virulent, quote, eliminationist antisemitism, unquote, in the German identity, which had developed in the preceding centuries. So what he's saying is that Germans are born Jew haters. They're born Jew killers, in fact. This is a tremendous race-based libel against Germans, and by extension against the European peoples in general, because this is really the essence of the whole the Holocaust and the Jewish narrative as victims of European oppression. This long history, the Holocaust is just the most recent and the most glaring example of that. And this idea of eliminationism is echoed by people like David Nyward or Neward. I'm not sure how you pronounce that name. And I've encountered it also in when arguing with a fellow named Lawrence Oster. He likes to go around calling it exterminationist antisemitism. It's just a slight variation. Like he likes to use the word separationism instead of separatism. He comes up with his own words for what somebody else has already actually thought of. Well, anyway, as I mentioned quickly, this idea of eliminationism is really an inversion of reality. White people are the ones being eliminated and being aggressed against here, and yet the eliminationism that Goldhagen and Nyward and Oster are so excised about, so care so much about, and are so opposed to, is, of course, they think the Jews are the targets of exterminationism, eliminationism, and that they're the ones that need to be protected, you know, from any criticism. Because criticism, of course, is the first step toward trying to eliminate people. And I say we take them seriously at that. I think this is the projection part, that this is they're aware in their own minds that that's the first step, and yet they do it to white people. So that's how we ought to regard it. When people are guilt-tripping us and defaming us as a people, that's what their intent is. Their goal is elimination, extermination, and they're just projecting those thoughts onto us. That's what their suspicion is of our motives. So I think I've wrapped up this two-part series here, and I hope you all enjoyed it, and come back the next time, and probably it will be related. The next time will be somewhat related to this, but maybe a little bit off in a different direction. See you next time.